Welcome to the Soulcast. Today's guests are the Bass and BK, and we're going to be talking about
the revolutionary abolitionist movement, a political movement dedicated to freeing people from bondage and building resistance in the states. We situate our political movement in the context of the abolitionist struggle against slavery and continuing the tradition from Nat Turner to the Black Liberation Movement. We believe the Civil War was never resolved and the system of slavery transitioned into the prison industrial complex. Our struggle today must begin from the starting point. Lastly, as revolutionary anarchists, the abolitionist struggle must be extended to the state and capital, the perpetuators of oppression. The revolutionary movement in the U.S. today is at a crossroads as fascist movements are expanding and the state becomes increasingly authoritarian. The roach of a revolution in Syria provides us with the model for revolution today, with its foundation in communal and council-based political organization and militant defense.
All right, well, it doesn't totally rhyme, but gets the point across. I was starting to read it, and I was like, oh, this would sound better if I rapped it like Nas. But yeah, thanks for tuning in to the Soulcast. Like I said, I'm going to be interviewing the folks from the Bass about the revolutionary abolitionist movement. We're going to have a wide-ranging conversation about the importance of education and discussion and self-defense, and then we're going to talk about the revolutionary abolitionist movement, which basically it has this real deep analysis that starts with slavery and the beginning of capitalism and genocide and the destruction of the new world and how all the systems that were put in place at that point that's kind of like the point that we have to go back and take a serious look at and see how it's rippled through. And although the systems of exploitation and slavery, it's everything has just shifted and changed names. And so what this movement really does is it kind of picks up the pieces from all these struggles that have been happening, these seemingly separated struggle, and puts forth a proposal based on revolutionary solidarity. It takes aim at the prison industrial complex. It takes aim at ICE. It takes aim at capitalism and the state, and provides a framework based upon what's happening in Rojava and northern Syria as a model to say this is how here's one way we can do it. And of course, it's just a proposal. It's a really short book. It's 48 pages. So if anybody wants to go check it out, I implore people to go read it. I mean, it's a quick read, but it's an awesome read. So check the book out. You know, you can order it online, and they're right now they're in this stage where they're trying to launch chapters and get this going all over North America. So if you hear what these folks are talking about and it resonates with you, consider getting it popping where you live, because it's an amazing opportunity to build solidarity beyond protest and beyond a lot of the work that's been happening and kind of putting those pieces together. So without further ado, here's the interview. The Bass, Brooklyn, what's up, y'all?
What's
hey,
up?
How are you?
Representing. What's cracking?
How y'all doing?
We're good. Yeah, just chilling. Happy to be here.
I'm happy to be here, too. Who am I speaking with right now?
I'm Layla.
And I'm Khalid.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for doing this interview. You know, I was supposed to do it last week. My computer broke. You know, I know y'all have busy schedules, so thanks for taking the time.
Of course, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, it's awesome to be on.
Yeah, we're hyped.
Well, what, talk about the book, I guess, can you talk about the Bass a little bit and what that is and what y'all are doing?
Okay, yeah, the Bass, it's a political social center in Brooklyn, in Bushwick. The space has been around now for about 4 years, I think it is. And when it first started, the idea was to make an explicit anarchist center, political hub in the city, since there wasn't one. The idea kind of spawned around the demise of Occupy Wall Street. When Occupy Wall Street was dying, a lot of us were like, you know, it was cool that there was like a park and people could like, you know, meet up and do stuff and find the radicals, but there's nothing explicitly anarchist in the city for anarchists to come and to engage with the larger public. So one thing was we wanted to have a place for anarchists to meet and to work on political projects. and two, we wanted to make a place that was open public infrastructure to relate into work with the general public, so we could introduce these ideas to people concretely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when we first opened, like, our idea was to have, like, resources, like a lending library, have different kinds of, like, workshops, have talks from people from different parts of the world that were organizing in their own cities and towns. Then we started getting into more organizing projects because we realized, like, okay, well, once we had, like, a bunch of people that we were working with through that, now we could actually start trying to do stuff, like, kind of, we're looking at, like, the Black Panthers services, and we're like, that's really clever what they did. Now can we do that anarchistically, so to involve people in, like, mutual aid and other ways of helping out outside the state, to, like, actually involve them in pragmatic ways of doing stuff, and to get to know it that way, too. So for the last couple of years, we did things like a tenant solidarity network, Cop Watch, and some other organizing projects.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's been really cool to just watch it from afar. I mean, I'm just so jealous. Like, I wish we had that here in Denver.
Oh.
But I mean, like, I guess some of the, I mean, I get, would you, I mean, obviously the it seems like education is a huge part of what y'all do over there. Like, it seems like there's always lectures and reading groups, and is it like different people who come for different stuff, or is it like the same people, or?
When it started, especially when it started, it was really radically different people for everything. So, and it's funny too, because people would come to one thing and think that was like the tone of the space, but it's like, it really changes every single group, every discussion. It's like totally different people every single time. And the educational thing we think is really important, in that, like, a lot of people nowadays, and I guess for a long time, it's not probably very that recent, but a lot of people don't know much about anarchist or communist history, or a lot of political history in general. Like, a lot of people kind of, they understand the anti-authoritarian spirit of anarchism, but not where it necessarily comes from historically in the lineage. And so we're trying to help position it in a really complete political historical context with the space.
Yeah, and it was real helpful because when we, kind of, I guess, like a year into when we started, Khaled did an introduction to anarchism reading group, and that was so good because we met a lot of people through that, and we're able to, like, talk through ideas and kind of work our ideas more closely together, so then when it came time to do organizing projects, we were all on the same page.
That's so important. I mean, it's I look at what y'all are doing, and then I kind of, like, compare that to the Black Rose Federation, and mm-hmm. and I feel like when the Black Rose was starting up here, I was like, I don't want to be forced to read all this shit. Like, I want to read what I want to read. And it just felt a little too, like, it felt like I liked where they were coming from, and, like, the ideas of social insertion, and the ideas that the role of the radical, one role a radical can play is to be a hard left pull in social movements to draw people to the left, you know? And I feel like in a lot of ways, what y'all are doing is similar, but it's almost more, it's more specific. I mean, does Black Rose operate out of your space?
No, they don't. And it's not like there's no, they used to do events there, but they've been going through some, like, different internal changes. So we'd imagine they'll be back soon at some point, but they don't actually use it as a hub of operations or anything. But we sympathize with him. I like the idea of, like, trying to push things as far as possible.
Mm,
that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a couple other groups or collectives that meet there, like Anarchist Black Cross meets there. The IWW meets there sometimes or does workshops there. So there is, like, kind of like a diverse range of projects, which was our goal in the beginning, you know, that, like, because we were thinking that, like, actually, like, nobody really has, like, the magic bullet right now. Everybody has, like, different approaches and ideas. So, if we could do something that's a little bit more decentralized, like have the space be really decentralized, different groups or different individuals could plug in and try different kinds of projects, like educational projects, organizational projects, and then we'll just see. We'll see, like, what works, like what sticks, you know?
I love that. It reminds me of, because I'm real big on, like, the Invisible Committee, Tycoon stuff, and it reminds me of, like, you know, how they're, seems like they're like looking at Silicon Valley a lot as like this hub of this model of innovation, and you know this hub where people can get together and like, you know, almost like a workshop or something. And I feel like it's clear that the base has become that in New York, you know, like this, not like a Silicon Valley, but a place where ideas are colliding and things are coming out of it. And it's cool.
Yeah. Hopefully it goes someplace good.
Yeah, definitely.
So in that line, you just published this book, called the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement. And when I first saw the videos, I wasn't quite clear on what it meant. But then after reading through the book, you know, and again, this all comes out of the base, right? This project.
Yeah. Like a bunch of people who've been meeting there, collaborating there, and working on projects and programming it for the last couple years did this. And I think it kind of came out from a little bit like we were doing a lot of organizing projects that we thought were very useful and helpful. But the hard part was to find collaborators or to have like a really concerted political basis was more difficult, you know, because anybody can get involved in an organizing project, but they might not agree politically. So after we had those experiences the last couple of years, we realized, actually, like, it doesn't really matter exactly what you're doing. Like, you could be, like, putting up a flyer, you're making a website, you could be doing the most militant action in the world, like, as long as it was underpinned with kind of the same revolutionary horizon, then you could have something that's really coordinated, working towards, like, an actual revolutionary goal. So that was a little bit our motivation for doing that.
Yeah, and also, With what's happened in the last like 4 or 5 years or so, like you had Occupy, you had the Black Lives Matter movement, you have all these like beautiful uprisings, then you had this big wave of reaction. But there isn't like there have been a lot of things that have been noticeably absent that we're trying to make do with now, since there are so many social political problems, and we felt we needed some kind of organizational capacity to deal with this in the city and in the larger scale around the country. That's kind of where the impetus comes from.
Yeah, what I love is it's not afraid to dream really big. You know, it's pushing for things that are immediate and pushing for things that are really far off. So can you talk a little bit about the book and the project and goals of it are?
Okay, well, the goals are pretty ambitious, but we think we tried to root the political struggle in this country back into the abolitionist struggle from the 19th century, and we argue in there that most of the political struggle from then up until May the 90s, our Black Lives Matter movement, stems from that same kind of tradition, which is rooted in the black struggle in the U.S. So we argue in the text that the first point is that slavery never ended, that it was merely transformed after the Civil War. And it finds its current incarnation in the criminal justice system with mass incarceration. So we argue that, like, for a struggle to have any kind of resonance and to go where it needs to go, it has to grapple with abolishing slavery in the 21st century, since it wasn't abolished in the first Civil War. So to follow up on that, we also argue that the Civil War never actually ended, that the same conflict that was going on in the 1860s continues today, and that it bubbles up in different ways, but it's pretty much the same exact conflict. So you see continuity from the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement to what was going on in the Reconstruction period in the 1870s. And then when the Black Power Movement is dissolved with state repression in the 70s and 80s, you see the same things bubbling up again with the Black Lives Matter Movement. So it's like the same conflict is never actually solved. So we argue that for anarchists and militants around the country to focus on what they're doing, they have to position themselves towards fighting for this specific goal.
Yeah, because we're kind of looking at that, how like a kind of carceral state perfected what it does like on the black population as well as on the native population in terms of genocide. But this kind of precision they have and brutality, then it's applied to many other different populations. Whoever gets othered, whoever is like they want to declare a criminal, ends up feeling the wrath. So we're thinking if we can situate it historically, we could also look at the kinds of solutions people came up with historically and then root our resistance in those too, like looking at the Maroons, looking at the Black Panthers and the BLA, and then drawing from them, drawing from their successes, drawing from the lessons they learned, figure out how to position ourselves within that tradition of resistance that leads towards a revolutionary situation.
Yeah. So if I could further up too with that, we argue in the text that the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army specifically, that political group was the most successful political group in the 20th century, and that they, but their main one of their main shortcomings, except for, like, there is authoritarianism and a lot of other problems, but there is also that the above ground and underground organizations didn't get to correspond properly due to state repression and also due to not thinking about being in war before they're engulfed in war. And that's a lesson I think that people should take away from the book. And also we're calling for a 21st century underground railroad, and that with the advent of these huge ICE raids, with a huge amount of Black population being in prison, with the increase in hate attacks and hate crimes, that if you can get people out of the state's hands and away from these hate groups, you can end up building a stronger militant movement through that process.
Yeah, and one of the things... Oh, were you about to say something?
No, that's it.
And one of the things I really liked about the book is how it's like, you know, you're like, start where you live. Like, not, you know, not at the, you know, not where you and your homies are meeting up and, you know, discussing insurrectionary theory. Like, start on your block. Like, the revolution begins with neighborhood councils, with building with your neighbors, and building out from there. So can you talk about how you see that working, or what the thinking is behind starting from a block by block strategy?
Well, I mean, I guess the most clear part of that is we wanted to figure out how we could build towards a revolutionary situation in a very localized, like, anarchist sense. So if things come down to the most local basis, like localized defense, a localized council, then you can always ensure to maintain that decentralization and ground up power. And we've been really inspired by the revolution in Rojava and following it very closely, talking to people who've been there. So we've been studying how these mechanisms work over there, and then kind of brainstorming and thinking about how they could be applied here, like in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And the other thing I really liked was the tech mill. I'd never heard of that before. Can you talk about what that is? I was just imagining if we had a tech mill practice in, like, early days of Occupy. Like, I just wonder, like, shit, would all of these... Would we all be getting along, and would we have already had a revolution? Like, I don't know. You know?
Yeah, so it seems, well, in Rojava, it comes from, originally from the Maoist tradition of criticism and self-criticism, but they've, like, built on it into something a little bit better. And everyone who's there seems to, who's been there, seems to say it's one of the most important things for, like, group cohesion and building trust. So, what they do is, they, after everything, after any kind of class, after any kind of, like, workshop, after any kind of, military mission, they come back and they self-reflect on what went well, what went wrong. They talk about, like, group dynamics, if somebody feels that they weren't, you know, that they were being mistreated by someone else. And they have to, it's not an all-day process. It's supposed to be a pretty quick thing. And they have a bunch of principles that they operate by, so if somebody is violating those principles, it becomes clear quickly. So one thing, it's supposed to break down group hierarchy. So if you have a commander during a military mission, when you come back, he's on the same platform as everyone else. He's not, like, at the top, or she's not at the top. Then, and it also helps diffuse resentment, which everyone says is really big. So if, like, two people aren't getting along, you can work that out there, and it doesn't just sit and fester like we do here, like we have here.
Yeah.
And one thing we think is really important too is because in the U.S. we mainly have call-out culture, where people, you know, call on each other out, like, oh, you're a fucked up person, you're this, you're that, or it spills onto the internet and people make websites about each other. And we think it would be healthy to try to implement some kind of process like this in our collective so that we could diffuse conflict in productive ways that build us up as comrades instead of tearing each other apart all the time.
The thing that's so beautiful about it that we heard recounted was that it's really the opposite of the kind of punitive system that we have in the U.S., but instead, like, all the criticisms should come from the perspective that you believe in your comrade and want to see them improve as a person and become more capable. So that's a completely different perspective, and I think, like, essential if we're actually building towards a situation where we'd have conflict resolution bodies instead of courts and trials and jails.
Right, and that's kind of what accountability almost looks like in the circles I've seen, where there, you know, things always boil over to the point where it's the only thing to do is declare someone a non-person and exile them because it's just there's too much water under the bridge. And I like the practice of you and your comrades, you know, doing this tech mill kind of shit, because it, like, I feel like it could play a role in preventing these conflicts from boiling over.
Yeah, definitely. Nice. A lot of people who have told us about it said that, like, for instance, if you did something like this in the States, you'd probably have to experiment because it's so, like, foreign. We're so used to just, like, building up resentments and, like, competing with one another that you'd probably have to experiment a bit, but we definitely, like, encourage people to, like, really think about how you can resolve conflicts with your comrades instead of letting your collectives fall apart.
The other thing that we found really, like, attractive about how they did it is that the principles were right up front. So we're noticing, like, right now, like, if we go to a street demo, a lot of people might go that we don't know. They might not know what our expectations are of them. We might not know what their expectations are of us, like how they'll react in a certain situation, or what if someone gets locked up? What do they say? What do they don't say? So with that, it's very useful to have those principles and ways of operating right up front, so everyone can say, okay, yes, we agree with this. We're going to abide by these principles. So when you come to the tech meal, it's not on a basis that's completely unknown. It's something that everyone already agreed to and signed up for and wants to be a part of.
Right. Here's one of the paragraphs I really liked in the book. I'm going to read it and maybe have you expand on this a little bit. Because this is something that I've really been, like, struggling to find the words for as I've been watching this Antifa stuff, and it's just feels very reactive, and, like, yes, we should be shutting down Nazis and they should be getting punched in the face, but you know, we need to think a little more about what we're doing. So the problems have become quite dire. The resistance, while occasionally militant, remains predominantly focused on protests and has had difficulty rising above them. Every few years, the resistance recreates itself without a conclusive strategic vision, and few revolutionary organizations arise to promote a new direction. Rebels focus on one-off militant demonstrations and the inevitable repression, and then wait for the next go around without enough serious thought about where these actions fit into the larger freedom struggle in the United States, or build up organizations capable of seizing territory, overthrowing the state, and abolishing slavery. I quit.
Yeah. Okay, well, yeah, we felt that was one of the main things we want people to take away from the book, in that we feel that, how should I put this, that the movements, especially stemming from the 90s on, and this isn't, I'd like to add an addendum, I don't think this is, like, any one or any group's particular, like, fault, but it's just, like, I think it's just kind of where we happen to be at the time, but...
Yeah, this is what we do. This is what we do.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry,
yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah, that we have constantly just organized for protests, and, like, a lot of us have been active for a long time, and it's, like, you know, you have some really big indignity, and everyone gets really mad, as they should, and everyone, like, gets together and has some really beautiful street demonstrations, and we really take it to the state, and then the state cracks down, and we all end up in prison, or a bunch of us end up in prison. We end up doing fundraisers for, like, a few months. We raise incredible amounts of money, and then we do it all over again. And it's like, to build a revolutionary movement, you can't really do that just by that same process. You have to build something that kind of has historical memory, and that can eventually build up capacity to engage the state in offensive and defensive military, not military, militant actions, I should say. So, and this is also why we're saying you need above ground, underground organizations, because if you have that to bring in new people, you have the underground thing that can increasingly gain capacity to fight, then you'll actually start building some kind of culture that has the potential to overthrow the state. And also, I'd like to add that the anarchist position for the revolutionary overthrow of the state, it's one of the most complicated political positions to take. So, like, to actually get to that role, the amount of thought and action and resources necessary is really stark. Which is also why we'd like to ask people to really focus on the Rojava Revolution, because they managed to do something that no one else has managed to do since Spain. And they're laying out some of the blueprints for how someone could actually think about organizing in that capacity right today. And it's not like in a foreign place. It's like it's here in this world, and you could read about it. You could go there. It's really a, you know, there's a lot to learn. And if we're going to try to, if we're going to abolish slavery in North Dakota State, it's like we have to really hunker down and put a lot of thought into this stuff.
Another, like, can you talk about how, like, you've kind of already touched on it, but I think another powerful thing about what you're laying out here is, like, you're not saying here is an anarchist mass movement that we want everyone to participate in. It's a very specific choice of vocabulary to say abolition. Like, we are modern day abolitionists. You know, 25% of Black Americans are in some point of contact with a probation officer or a jail, and that's a greater number of people that were, you know, under the gun of slave patrols back in the day. And, like, the way, like, what I really loved is, like, the history and the analysis that's painted out for, I guess, the first 30 pages of the book. And if you fail, like, even if you don't, like, let's just say this movement, you know, doesn't go all the way, at the very least, just putting the phrase, like, repopularizing the phrase abolitionist in today's context and, like, contextualizing it and then tying capitalism and slavery all together. I mean, it's just, it's great. So I guess, can you speak on just the choice of vocabulary of abolition and, speak to that a little more?
Yeah. I mean, we definitely, didn't invent it or anything, because I think it really had come back in the popular consciousness after the Black Lives Matter movement. But of course, then we were witnessing a lot of kind of reformist suggestions for abolition, like stronger civic governments that would have civilian review boards for police, or ways that were actually going to end up buttressing the state, and definitely weren't a solution in any way. And I think that especially with the rise of the far right in the U.S. right now, I think what a lot of people are witnessing is that the only people who are willing to stand up to that are anarchists. And I think that that's been really important for people to see, because for there to be a solution to this problem, it has to be stateless, and we have to combat capitalism. So really the only way to have a liberatory solution is through these very, very localized self-governance, through conflict resolution, through bringing down the carceral state, through combating capitalism, through combating the far right. So even though abolition is something that's already in the air and a lot of people are talking about it, and it's really important and really good that people are talking about that right now, we want to make it really clear that it was from a very specific revolutionary perspective, and that was the only way it's going to happen.
I'd also like to say, too, that we want to make sure that we rooted it in the historical traditions of the country, and that, like, that a lot of the anarchist culture in the U.S., it takes a lot of the struggles abroad as, like, a starting point, which makes sense, because, like, there's an anarchist tradition in the country, but it comes up, it's kind of destroyed around the Red Scare. You know, there's some stuff in the 60s in the U.S., but it usually takes more of, like, of inspiration from abroad, but we're arguing that there's, like, a really strong militant historical tradition here that we could all, that we could take up, and it stems from there.
I mean, I can't say that I'm, like, this super historian, but I definitely learned Like, I didn't, I mean, there's a lot of shit I learned just from your book. And, you know, I love how it's short, it's concise, and then every chapter ends with, like, summarizing, like, just in case you are of this generation that doesn't pay attention to shit. Like, here's, here are the bullet points, just, you know, so. Oh, God. Yeah.
You got some people sometimes.
Yeah, you gotta, you know, but you know, and I like that, you know, that you're not afraid to lay some shit out there. I mean, we're, you know, as anarchists, you know, I've been in a lot of situations where we're like, oh, we're gonna organize autonomously and we're gonna all get together, and then like people are just waiting for somebody to have an idea. And yeah. And then like the idea never emerges, and then so like, oh, here's the solidarity date, let's all go dress up in black and yell at the cops. I don't know. It's, but what I like is, and I also like seeing in some of the, what are some of the actions already that y'all have done, in the name of the revolutionary abolitionist movement? What are some of the, what are some ideas for things that people have already started doing that you can talk about?
Well, from our perspective, what we need in New York, and maybe if I could just backtrack for a second, because you brought up a really important point earlier about like not saying, oh, this is going to be a mass anarchist movement, because one thing that was really important that we wanted to build into it was that everybody knows best like what's happening in their town and their city, and what we want to do is just provide a framework for the struggle, say, okay, if this is what we're dealing with, this is the historical lineage, and this is the intention, is to get people out of bondage and make organizations that lead to this kind of revolutionary situation, then people who are on the ground in those cities are the ones that best know what actions they should take part in, or what's possible, what the terrain is like. So we wanted to make sure that kind of fluidity was built into it. For us in New York, we've been doing a more concerted educational program that's like a month-long school called the Kwesi Balogun Liberation School, named after ex-BLA member Kwesi Balogun. And through that, what we want to do is lay this all out, like right from the start, and say, this is the political perspective we're coming from. Here's some skills and tools that you can use to do this work. So how to organize a political project, how to do first aid, what we do when we're encountering ICE. So everyone can come to it and join the movement from this perspective, where they already have like been exposed to the political proposals. They agree with it, or they want to work within that, or add to it in some way. And they have like the skills necessary for being involved in political projects. So right now, predominantly, we're building that up. So I think that's really important, to have a lot of people that are all on the same page. Mm. And then we're also about to launch a couple organizing projects in like the next couple weeks or so. One's like a rapid response network, where there's a centralized number that people can call if they're in fear of a hate attack, or they think that ICE is trying to deport them. And the other is a community bail fund that will get people out of Rikers for low amounts of bail.
Yeah, so we're trying to get at least one person out every month. And that's like one of the first things we're going to do. We're trying to get at least one to two people out every month for a low amount of bail. And yeah, those are the first projects. But yeah, we're also not trying to focus so much on having street actions until everyone agrees that it would make some kind of sense. Right. So, like, once again, we're trying to move away from that just culture of protest, going out, bugging out, hoping for the best, getting beat up, beating some people up. And, once again, there should be a place for that, but we're just trying to do something a little different.
I mean, I saw there was a house demo recently at a prison, at some prison CEO in New York that was related to... House demos are always, I think, are great.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
we had a lot of success with that for our tenant solidarity network. They did not see that coming.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, pissed the landlords off a lot.
Did you have any successes with your tenant organizing?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, it went very well. It was one of the most successful things we think we've done at the base. Where like Yeah, we would, if people had some kind of complaint with their landlord, we would write like a list of demands and deliver it to the landlord, and we gave them usually 2 weeks. If they didn't meet the demands, we would escalate the campaigns, and they went really well. Yeah, most of the times, they usually resolved it. There was one case where he got really mad when we started like doing demos on his lawn. And he took the woman to court and demanded all this back pay, but she had all the documents showing she paid already. And I guess, I don't know if he was just too arrogant or it was a filing error, but the judge kind of threw him out of court, and, you know, so then he had to stop harassing her, so we won, and it was a bit of a legal victory, unfortunately, as opposed to a Milton victory, but the Milton action led to it, so it was good.
But the funny thing was, like, we actually, in the course of that campaign, we'd put letters in all of his neighbors' mailboxes, telling them, like, what he was up to kind of shame him a little bit. And, of course, he, you know, got hold of the letter, and he brought it to court and showed the judge, look what these people have done to me. And the judge said, well, yes, that is very mean, but it's actually irrelevant here.
That's awesome. Yeah, we did that also at the district attorney. We, like, because none of his neighbors knew who he was. And so we were like, all right, well, now they all know you're a fucking asshole, you know.
Awesome.
So, that's great.
Gotta expose them.
Yeah, I mean, because it just personalizes it in a way, and it's such a low risk that
exactly.
And again, that's another thing in your book where, you know, a lot of the stuff y'all list are really, really, like, low key, sort of escalation-y kind of stuff. You know, it's not like, get 10 of your friends, you know, load up the AKs and rush the prison, you know. It's very nuanced. So can you talk about what role you see self-defense playing in the revolutionary abolitionist movement?
Okay, yeah. So right now we're at the process of trying to help a lot of collectives get formed around the country, and we've been encouraging people that we say it's the more you have, like, say, a neighborhood assembly, or if you have a social center, or you have any kind of, like, political project that's, like, combative against the state or against the far right, at some point, you'll have to defend yourself. There's no way around it. So we've been encouraging people to learn self-defense, learn how to protect yourself. We do fight trainings at the base, for instance, like, 2 or 3 times a week. We have a lot of people who are in there getting swole. You know what I mean? So it's like... Yeah, so we think that regardless, whatever you're doing, when you're doing this, you're going to have to learn how to protect yourself. And eventually, as things progress, we could probably launch like more militant actions. We have a Black Bloc that's been doing it very well around the country for the last few years, and that's like one instance of militant action. But there are plenty of others, and we would encourage people to that. We think that's the first step for combating the state, is learning how to protect yourself and your comrades and the people in your neighborhood who are already facing state repression and oppression.
And it's been really encouraging, because actually people kind of know that that's happening at the base, the fight training. So people will come and say, okay, well, you know, we're worried about the far right, like, attacking people in our neighborhood. We'd like to train here and be ready to defend it. So the more we can build on that and actually start building these neighborhood defense groups from the ground up, we'll actually already be in position to have those neighborhood councils and be able to defend them, because we're feeling that whatever gains we make politically, we have to have the requisite force to back it up. Otherwise, it'll get run over in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when I go to these, you know, Milo demonstrations or whatever, these far right people, you know, they're not, you know, the ones who, I've seen people just jump into a crowd of Black Bloc people and just, you know, square up and be like, come on, who wants it, you know? And it's like, and I'm like, man, I haven't been in a fight in 20 years. Like, I don't even, you know what I mean? Like, punch through the face, like, you know, I don't know. So it's, yeah, I definitely think, you know, us vegans need to double down on them Cliff bars and get ready, because I mean, I don't feel very confident with my hands, and I'm a pretty, you know, I'm not big, but I'm not small, and yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people are in that same boat where it's like, you know, are we really ready to fight, you know, so. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you go. What were you saying?
Oh, just unfortunately, the far right is they love it, and they've been, you know, training for this for years, like with their militias and stuff, and planning horrific things. But the thing that we have on our side, I think, is that we actually have something worth fighting for.
Yeah, and maybe on a lighter note too. In New York, they had a demonstration, a bunch of them, not too long ago. And one of the dudes, with a little bit of heat, he keeled over and had a heart attack after his speech. So they're not doing so well either.
I saw that.
Yeah, so, you know, we won't need to worry too much about them. A lot of them aren't really doing so well either.
You know what? I also liked learning about the Maroons. Can you talk about the Maroons?
Yeah, for sure. So we actually drew from Russell Maroon Schott's book, and he talked a lot about them. And also from Dixie Be Damned, which had some excellent research about the Maroons. And it's so intriguing because these were autonomous communities that were made up of Native Americans, escaped slaves, and poor white people in the South. And they had like these autonomous communities that were well defended. The one we were really looking at closely was the Great Dismal Swamp, and that had kind of like a natural geographic defense, because the people who were in it knew how to navigate the swamp, and then whenever slave catchers or state forces tried to come in, they didn't know how, so they were slowed down by the swamp. But they had like great defense. They had self-organization, and apparently they were coordinated enough to the point where they were able to make incursions on plantations and free slaves, and they got to the point where they were going to start attacking state infrastructure, which is very intriguing, that they were concertedly trying to bring down the institutions that were allowing slavery to exist.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, again, I'd never even heard of them before, and I was just like, oh my god, this is cool. This shit's cool.
Yeah, so good.
Another thing you talk about in the book, and I'd like you to expand on it a little bit, is you mention, like, all at once, like, slavery, capitalism, the white race, genocide, and that's like, the way I read it is that's the moment really that you're trying to abolish, is like all those constructs. So can you talk about like the creation of capitalism and its, you know, its linkage with slavery and race?
Yeah. Well, we argue in, it's been argued elsewhere, we didn't like point this any or anything, but like the advent of all these things happens at about the same time historically. So you see like, right at the beginning of the slave trade is around the same time that period capitalism starts coming into being. So it's like it's interesting that like you start having these wage labor contracts, but at the same exact time you have a whole population of people who are enslaved for free labor. And at the same time also you have these huge like terms, like for instance like Africa, Europe, the Americas, all these things start coming into existence around the same time. The term black, white, like African people who were enslaved, they didn't refer themselves as black or African, but it was through this process of colonization and the state formation and all this that leads to all these terms having any kind of meaning. So then, as you like have Americas being built up, that is when all the racial codification begins, and the advent, once again, the advent of capitalism. So you have like these people who start working for wages in the North. And then you still have slavery down south. But then it's interesting how these two things go together. This one theorist, Frank Wilderson, he argues that this notion of bondage and terror, a relation of terror, he calls it, is closer to the core of capitalism than simple wage exploitation. That like there's a certain reason why slavery comes about at the same time that you start having these notions of wage slavery. So we think that it's all really tied together. So it's abolish the anti-blackness or the state, you have to take all these things together, that they're all developed together, or probably have to be abolished together in tandem.
Right on.
Yeah.
Can you also speak about the role you see gender or abolishing gender playing in this project?
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because we were trying to put forward the idea that the same mentality that creates a carceral state also creates a kind of prison within gender. So having specific gender roles is something that the state specifically exploits to be able to kind of control the population. So we were really interested in looking at situations where self-liberation also allowed for this kind of like freeing of gender constraints. So we were kind of looking at Harriet Tubman, who herself was just a phenomenal person, set an incredible standard that we should all live up to, by freeing herself from slavery and then going on to free other people and be a huge participant in the Underground Railroad, and who became known for, well, now she's known as this kind of like cute grandma, which is kind of like a mischaracterization because John Brown described her as like one of the best military commanders like he'd known. So that kind of way of like freeing oneself goes along with freeing oneself from gender constraints. We're also looking specifically at the Yazidis. I don't know if people are familiar with that too well, but I think it was 2014 that ISIS came through and tried to genocide the Yazidi population and take all the women as sex slaves. It was a super dire situation, and they didn't have the capacity to defend themselves. The people who were supposed to actually ran away. It was the YPG, Rojava's militia, that was able to intervene and actually push ISIS back and then help them build up their own militias, like one that was mixed gender and one that was an all-female militia. And the thing that's so incredible about the story is that the all-female militia went on to liberate a lot of their friends and sisters and neighbors who had been taken as sex slaves, and those very same people joined the militia and then were able to empower themselves through it to prohibit that from happening again. So we're looking, we're trying to look at defeating the state or defeating these kind of institutionalized gender roles as one and the same with kind of self-liberation, and it has to go in tandem to work.
Well, I bet Gavin McGinnis would have something to say about that. sorry, I had to. He lives there, right?
He's an asshole.
I'll have to get to us first.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, another thing that I, you know, like one of the most popular slogans is smash the state. I don't even think that's like the proper phrase anymore. I don't know if this is how you see it happening, but when I look at places where, you know, autonomous, seems like the only way revolutionary projects are really happening in a real way anymore are when they become these autonomous, you know, building a new world in the shell of the old kind of model. I don't know. Do you have anything to say about smashing the state versus building a new world, building autonomy in the shell of the old?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like the way that we're trying to think about it organizationally is that they have to go hand in hand, you know. So to be able to build up enough people that agree politically, that have a specific idea about what world they're working towards, you also have to build up the requisite force to defend that and to be able to go on the offense. So we're thinking of those two things as really going hand in hand.
Yeah, definitely. And we think that a lot of the places that are most exciting there. The revolutionary overthrow of the state, I wouldn't say that's off the table. It's just that, like, I think we're all experimenting with new forms of resistance. I think there's a lot of potential now for how to bring that forward. especially since the left is so embattled in a lot of the world. Like, you see, like, in Latin America, all these, like, was it the Pink Tide? All these leftist governments are completely discredited now. None of them are doing very well. They haven't actually, like, raised the standard of living very well for a lot of people. They've done some stuff that raised the standard of living, but they've also not really created a more liberatory society. So I think that it's, like, it's time to start experimenting with new forms of revolution.
Yeah. Right on. Well, so what am I, this is a question I have that's mainly about the base. I mean, is there anything else about the revolutionary abolitionist movement that you want to put out there that we haven't touched on that people need to understand or that you want people to think about?
I guess, like, one thing we can mention is that, you know, we think that a lot of the forms of organizing people are doing right now, I should also say that they're really good. Like, I've been so encouraged to see Antifa really stepping up to the moment and, like, going out to battle these boneheads in the streets. It's been really, really enheartening to see that everyone has that gusto. And that we hope that people who feel the need to do that will be interested in this idea that we're putting forward. And, you know, we really hope that we can build this together with people, and people will get in touch with us, and we can do that.
Yeah, definitely. And we don't, yeah, please, like, hit us up, email us, hit us up. We're going to be going all around with the book, promoting it a bit. And the whole main point is that we can start building this, a strong movement that can really combat the state and create alternative forms of organization to push us in the 21st century so we can finally say death to America.
after my own heart. what about, are you coming to Denver? Do you plan to come out here?
We'd like to, definitely.
Yeah, let's make it happen.
Awesome.
I represent.
Yeah, you can come out. It's come out here and smoke some weed. Oh God. edibles or dabs, whatever, you know, fucking shoot it up. Maybe by the time you come on here, people will be shooting weed up because nothing else is working anymore. But no, seriously, I mean, it's like, God, it's so fucking, it's like this is crazy out here. The education series that y'all are doing, do you have plans of making the reading list a public thing so that people who are interested in, like, who dig the book and like what you have to say can, like, dig deeper into what you're talking about?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, if you go to KwesiBalagoon.org, we have a reader that we put together on there that's, like, it's pretty thorough. I think it's, like, 400 or 500 pages. It's got a lot of text that inspired all of us in New York, and that we've been encouraging people to read. It's got a lot of different good stuff. It'll set you right where you want to go. It'll get you ready to get yourself in some big trouble.
That's fucking great. Fucking New York. Fucking New York. You know, it's like, I remember right after Occupy, like, the strike debt manual came out, you know? And I went and I tried to use it, and none of the shit in there worked. You know, I still got stuck with my debts, and I was like, you know, and I feel like this, I'm not, like, just trying to bash everybody here, but it's like, I really like what you've done with this book, and I hope people check it out you know, try this stuff out, and then whatever's not working, you can change in the second edition, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And there's also, we'd like to add one more thing. If you check out the website, revolutionaryabolition.org, we have the book in PDF if you don't have any bread, if you want to just read online. It's on there, so you can read it for free there, too. You don't have to throw any money at us if you don't want to, even though we'd appreciate it. And also, if you are having trouble organizing, we have an option on the website to hit us up, and we might be able to send someone to your town to try to help you set up some stuff. So just holler at us, and we'll see what we can do.
That's fucking awesome. It must be great to be funded by George Soros and just be to send people all over the world.
You know what the checks are like. They're really big. I have this big-ass diamond chain right now.
Oh. Yeah. Well, oh, God. Just for the record, you're not funded by George Soros.
No, no, of course not. No.
You never know. Like, these stupid-ass right-wing motherfuckers who are, like, trying to dox us all the time, like, they're going to listen to this and be like, I knew it. You know, the base.
I wish. No, we're barely making it.
But if Soros is listening and wants to fund us, we'll take it.
Yeah.
Just tone it down a little bit.
Yeah.
Like originally when I reached out to y'all on Twitter, what I really wanted to pick your brain about is how to do a social center. And you know, like, I feel like, you know, as we've through this conversation, this awesome work y'all have put together, it's like the result of having this physical space. So I guess before we start with that, can you just talk about the importance of having physical space to organize out of and you know, why you think that's important? I mean, it's obvious, but I mean, I guess it's still good to, it's good to repeat ourselves.
Over and over again. it's really big, seriously, in that, like, yeah, without having a space, a lot of stuff that we've accomplished would have been completely impossible. It's, because you need to start building up stuff, one, to, for your comrades to be able to, like, really collaborate and work well, and then, two, you need to have some kind of way to relate with the public outside of, like, demonstrations or marches. So, like, you can really sit down and just chop it up and drink some coffee and argue and maybe become friends or become enemies, and you learn where everyone stands, but it's a great part in just, like, one, like, typical basic human development, also setting up political tone in your neighborhood. So it's like, you know, with the base, for instance, when we're here, some people might come by and they might be like, you know, abolish NYP, that sounds crazy, but they know us and they know that we're coming from a really pure place, and they start to understand what the NYPD means in the neighborhood. So, you know, it changes everything if you can't do it. Now, it's complicated, though. The process of setting up something like a political or a social center is a little difficult, but it's like something anyone could do. It just depends on coordination and pig-headed.
Yeah, the way we did it is we fundraised for a while till we had, like, enough money for kind of, you know, putting, like, the first month, security, etc. But then what we did is we asked people to contribute with monthly donations. So that's worked out pretty well because people can give what they have. Like, if someone has $5 a month, that helps. If someone has $50 a month, that helps. And that kind of offsets the cost of, well, for the rent and then for the utilities and stuff. So that's actually made it work pretty well.
Can you talk about, like, what kind of thinking went into, like, in the very early stages of the base? Like, how many people were involved? Like, how did you do it? How did you create, like, a working group that was capable of pulling this off?
Well, it was funny, actually, because we had all these, like little working groups for different stuff to start with, like, you know, outreach, infrastructure, whatever, and they immediately fell apart.
What? Shocking. Shocking.
So then we're like, okay, well, that's not going to work. But actually, like, it was okay because, like, our overall vision for it was that what we wanted to do is have it kind of more decentralized. So everyone was really married to consensus, we felt like, really, is, like, kind of like a standard go-to for political projects. But since we had both just come out of collective housing situations that were not ideal, we kind of had become disillusioned with the kind of consensus process. As really as kind of like a microcosm for democracy, where kind of majority rule kind of thing, or it's kind of weird backroom deals where everyone isn't really happy. So we're like, oh, well, what if we could set up this infrastructure where people could plug in and they don't have to be subject to the oversight or kind of censure by another group, so that each individual, each group, would be able to do whatever political vision or project they wanted to without somebody else saying, oh, y'all fucking up, or this is some bullshit, or whatever. So we actually, like, we tried that out to start with, and I think it's worked a little bit better. I guess we haven't really, like, reflected on it as much as we should to see if that was the best way of organizing. But the thing that's good is that I think that whenever the group is in the space, they can kind of make those make decisions about how things go, which makes sense, and it doesn't have to become some kind of like monitoring board.
Right. Well, yeah, it seems like your schedule's always full.
Right.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, but I guess my main question though is like specifically like to get it started. You got the money. How many people did you need to actually pull this off? Like, how many people were actually doing something? You know, was it just the two of you? Was it 8 people? Was it 12? I'm selfishly asking because we keep talking about trying to do it here, and Denver's expensive like Brooklyn is, and so it's like, yeah, if y'all can do it, we can do it, you know?
Definitely, you guys can do it. For sure. Yeah, I guess it was kind of like, there were a lot of anarchists around that were active in different levels, you know? So some people were just down to give money, or some people were like, I don't know if it's going to work, but like, I'll give you some, you know, some money or whatever. So everyone kind of contributed like different things that they had. So it was kind of like just a matter of figuring out like on what level people wanted to be involved or like could be involved and had the capacity, and then figuring out how to make that happen. So I think we started off like having like these like kind of working groups or like kind of collective like meetings, and that was probably between 10 and 15 people like all together, but since it immediately fell apart, it kind of ended up with a situation where you know, we were asking different groups already to like plug in or like schedule programming and stuff, so people were kind of just starting to plug into it in the way that made sense for them, I guess, if that makes sense. So people were like, okay, well, I don't have time to do a program, but I could give you $50 a month, like, that's already like really, really helpful, you know. So I guess it was just a matter of like communicating to people like what we're trying to do, what we needed, and then people could figure out like exactly how they wanted to contribute.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Fuck. It sounds like so much work. I guess the thing that, like, do you have to do a lot of cleaning? Like, to me, that would seem like the least glorious aspect of running a space is having to just keep it tidy.
Oh, yeah. It's never clean. yeah, and I guess, like, that's part of the process of, you know, is that kind of like revolutionary existence that maybe doesn't exist quite yet, but to get to that point where everybody thinks, you know, I'm responsible for everything that happens here, I'm responsible for my community, it's definitely a slow process.
That's great. And so is it a thing where you have like monthly sustainers where people donate every month?
Or yeah, exactly. And then like we have people who are like subscribers that we never met before, but maybe they live in a different state or a different part of the city, and they just want to like contribute, which is, you know, so helpful. You know, like even if someone doesn't have time to like program it or like come to stuff, like even that helps. You know,
right? And that's why it's important to have, you know, some sort of online presence to communicate what you're doing with the outside world, so that people can, you know, see what you're doing, be like, oh, I like that reading group, I'm going to do that.
Yeah, for sure. That's actually something that, you know, beyond the mechanics of like operating it, like beyond the mechanics of like, you know, updating Facebook or scheduling events or whatever, I think like really like the most important thing about it is having like really consistent pure lines. So when people see that we never charge for events, when they see that we're constantly saying like, you know, our radical positions, not watering it down, I think it builds trust a little bit, because like they can see that we're doing it for a specific reason and not for like personal gain or, you know, some other nefarious reason.
Yeah, that's great. Is it? And yeah. But you have day jobs as well, right? And so this is just a.
Yeah. No, we all work way too much. Way too much. Yeah. I've been working 12 hours a day, actually.
Jeez,
this month, one day.
Youth.
Yeah.
That's coffee. No, it's coffee.
Definitely coffee.
Monster energy drinks. Yeah, but one good thing we've been in, this might sound like a bit of a dig, but one thing we've been really adamant about trying to do is to try to make it clear that anarchism isn't necessarily just about, like, vegan bake sales and people, you know, having a fun time with each other, that you have to be, like, really fighting on the side of people who are oppressed, and that's where the movement finds its strength, that we're not going to get anywhere unless you're really organizing to overthrow and to change the social situation. So it's like, you know, it's not really about us as opposed to positioning what we're all doing politically to help people and to change things.
Yeah, and that's what I think is, again, I was like, you know, reflecting off the Antifa stuff lately, and I was just thinking, man, I'm, you know, it's like, it's shit so white right now, like, how can we broaden the struggle out? And you know, what y'all are doing is just picking up the pieces from, you know, looking at Black Lives Matter and looking at all this stuff, and it's true. It's situating yourself with, you know, and it allows for more collaboration on a, you know, to create true revolutionary solidarity, you know, amongst different races and classes, as opposed to things that are like culturally associated as, oh no, that's just for white people, you know.
No, it's good too. And the one good thing too about, like, white people should be fighting on the side of people who are oppressed. So it's like, for people to be putting themselves on the line in itself is a good thing, you know? Because, like, people could resign themselves and go back into the suburbs and chill and let the cards fall where they may. So it's better people are out there struggling, you know? And the more we struggle together, the more things will hopefully get better, or at least we'll die trying.
And that was another one of the lines in the book that really hit me, was people always say, oh, if I was alive in those times, I'd have fucking taken up arms and, you know, freed the slaves myself. And then it's like, these, you know, motherfuckers are so privileged today that they don't even recognize that we are living in those times. So
yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And you can also see the same thing about, like, people always talk about, like, the Spanish Revolution, but there's something akin to that going on right now, but people aren't flying there to go fight either. There are some people who are holding it down, but a lot of people aren't doing that. So it's like, you know, people have to realize that, like, Cerruti, Che Guevara, you know, Huey Newton, these people aren't, like, figures. They're just people who are just keeping it real, you know? And anyone can keep it real. It's just a matter of doing it.
Mm.
Right, and another thing you point out in your book is how that revolution in Rojava, or Rojava, however you pronounce it, has been going on for longer than the Spanish Civil War. The anarchists were doing their thing, and it's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're really lucky, too, that there's, like, a explicitly anarchist militia in Rojava right now, the International Revolutionary People's Guerrilla Forces. So people who come from, like, a kind of specifically anarchist background can learn a lot from them, their experiences in the struggle, their experiences in their home countries, and their, you know, people can participate on that level.
Yeah. And there's one thing that I don't know if people thought about, but I can't think of one time in probably the last century where a political organization lets a group of people just come up and set their own guerrilla force, let them just set up shop and do them. That never really happened, you know, which is pretty cool. It's another cool thing at Rojava.
Is crazy. Yeah. And it sucks. Yeah. It sucks that Murray Bookchin, you know, fucking died 5 years before he could even, you know, or whatever, 6 years. Well, he, you know, he died just right before that shit popped off. And it's like,
it's crazy. What are the chances of that?
100% actually are the chances. This pretty much happens with everything.
That's true.
So, yeah,
that's true.
99%. You know?
Yeah.
We are.
Yeah, definitely.
We are the 99%.
Oh, oh, no.
Oh,
no. Oh,
God. All right. Well, before I wrap up, I like to ask people. Oh, and, you know, another thing, one other, like, point I'll make is two people from one of the first, I think the first anarchist that died in Rojava was from Colorado, and I saw that New York Rojava Solidarity did a thing like held a demo for him, and like, you know, and you know, his family saw that, and his I'm friends with some of his friends, and people were really moved by the by that solidarity. And it's so I guess I just wanted to shout out Colorado and say, hey, we have some people over there fighting and dying on the side of the revolution.
Yeah.
We're, I mean, his Jordan McTaggart's participation in the revolution and sacrifice for it really touched us and brought it home. And the kind of seriousness that he brought to it is something that we want to bring to our struggle here. So we hope that at least we can continue on his legacy like that.
Word. And if his family's listening, we have his picture up in the base too as a tribute. So yeah, his memory lives on for sure.
Oh, you know what? If you could email me a photo of that, I'll send it to his friend to pass on to his mom.
That'd be word, awesome. Definitely.
That'd be very nice. Well, yeah. What I you know, I don't know if you have any last points you want to make or any last digs in you want to get in on our comrades before we... No, I'm just kidding. Before we go.
Oh, man. I got a bunch of... there's a bunch of different things. Check out New York City Anarchist Black Cross and all the Anarchist Black Crosses around the country. Definitely read up on the political prisoners because, like, there's a wealth of information that people need to learn that they haven't read about. What's it? Russell Maroon Schultz. He has a book called The Implacable Maroon, which was one of our biggest influences for writing this text in the first place. He has a huge wealth of information about revolutionary struggle in the United States and how we could further it. We have about Kwesi Balogun, the Shakur family. There's so much to learn. So, like, definitely kick all that knowledge. And as a New Yorker, I'd like to say I'd like to drop one thing. We lost a heavyweight today. Prodigy from Mobb Deep just passed away, and you know, we've all been really emotional about that. He was, we all grew up with Shook One, Eye for an Eye. You know, it's hard losing someone of that stature in New York.
Rest in peace, Prodigy. Yeah, I just saw that online. I was gonna ask y'all about that, but I forgot.
That's
he's so young too.
Yeah, 42. Yeah, that was a minute. That's why I came up with. That's who all came. Godfather Part 3, Apostle's Warning. You know, Prodigy.
I got you stuck off the realness.
Yep. Ain't no such thing as halfway crooks. Yeah, but yeah, also on top of that, yeah, just hit us up. Definitely message us at Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement. Hit up the, if you're in Brooklyn, come check out the base. We're doing big things. We're going to keep struggling and keep fighting. We're just getting started.
And thanks so much for taking the time.
You know.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's amazing.
Start from the beginning at the top of the list. Know what I mean? Half situation like this. Another war story from a thirsty young hustler. Won't trust her, I'd rather bust her and leave you caught for the cops to discover. Well, I'll be bipping in the Range Rover. Haunt you well like Liberace. You watch me while Jake's trying to knock me and lock me. But I'll be on the low sipping Osteo Spumante. Niggas try to creep on the side of my team. Stuck the heat through the window, rock their ass to sleep over a three-pack. Was a small thing, really, yeah. But keep letting them small things slide and be a failure. If I'm out of town, one of my crew will take care of you. The world is ours, and your team's inferior. You wanna bust caps, I get all up in your area. Kidnapping children make the situation scarier. Life is a gamble, we scramble for money. I might crack a smile, but ain't a damn thing funny. I'm caught up in the dirt where your hands get money. Plus the outcome turns out to be lovely. Got cheese in my pocket, hit off my main squeeze. Push back the sunroof, let the cold air breeze through the butter, soft leather upholstery. But mostly, keep the gag closely, cause niggas wanna toast me. And yo, I gotta get mines, no matter what the consequences. Count on my blessings, out of my weapons. Cop out the gat and let my nine serve purpose.
the grill, cause I wanna chill, laid up in a jacuzzi, sip a bubbly with my fingers on the Uzi. Try to infiltrate my fork, get caught dead up in New York. My brain is back with criminal thoughts. Get your life lost, never found again, my friend. Mission completed, watch you drop in less than 10. On my road to the riches, hitting snitches off with mad stitches. Your last rest, the place will be your ditch, kid. No one can stop me, try your style sloppy. You wanna be me, you're just an imitation copy. My theme is all about making the green, living up in luxury, pushing fat whips to live comfortably. Time goes by, and I for an eye. We in this together, son, your beef is mine. So long as the sunshine can light up the sky. We in this together, son, your beef is
a
mine.
A drug dealer's dream, stash cream, keys on a triple beam, 500 a cell green, 95 nickel gleam, condominium, thug dressed like a gentleman, tailor-made ostrich, Chanel for my women friend, murdering, numbers on your head while I'm burglaring, shank is serving them, what's up to all my niggas swerving in New York metropolis. The bridge brings apocalypse, shoot at the clouds, feels like the holy beast is watching us. Madman, my sanity is going like an hourglass. Gun inside my bad hand, I slice trying to bag grams. I got hoes that used to milk you, niggas who could've killed you. It's down with my ill crew of psychos. Nas Escobar moving on your weak production, pumping corruption in the third world, we just bustin'.
Hold up bustin'. And analyze the wildcats, sling cracks, they swinging axe. The new routines, be my eyes blacks. Playing corners, glancing all up in your cornea. Cornea, seen cats snatch money's upon ya. But late night, candlelight theme with a crack right. It's only right, feeling higher than an airplane right. Word yo, I wanna get this money then blow. Take my time, blast a nine if you're front you go. Sip beers, the German ones, hear my guns. Shallon and Queensbridge be robbing niggas for fun. But still write my will out to my seeds and bill. Mahalia sing a tale, but the real we still kill.
As time goes by, an eye for an eye. We in this together, so your beef is mine. So long as the sunshine to light up the skies. We in this together, so your beef is mine. As time goes by, an eye for an eye. We in this together, son, your beef is mine. So long as the sunshine can light up the skies. We in this together, son, your beef is mine. It's mine.